Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and it is Monday, February 29th. Now, that's special not just because it's Leap Day, which it is. Happy Leap Day, everybody. But also because this is the 100th episode of Talk Nerdy. I can't believe it. Like, it's blowing my mind as I'm saying the words out of my own mouth. Guys, I couldn't have done the show for as long as I have, 2 years now, if it weren't for you. So I want to start the show just like I do every week, thanking those of you who support it. I will start with those of you who have visited my page at patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged to support the show on an episodic basis. First, I want to thank Phil T-Bear, The Honorable Husband, Malcolm Wadi II, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeff Sewell. You guys alone have made Talk Nerdy much easier for me to produce on my end. But there are also like hundreds more of you who have given what you can, and I thank you so very, very much from the bottom of my heart. Over on the PayPal portal, which you can access by visiting carasantamaria.com, I want to thank, you actually said that you didn't need a shout out from me, but I think I want to thank you anyway. I hope that's okay. I'll just call you Rich. Thank you, Rich from Boston. Just really, really appreciate it. I also want to thank, Yoris? I think that's right, but let me see if you gave me a pronunciation in here. You did not. Yoris Bysemans from Belgium. Thank you so very much. And let's see, I think there's another one of you. There is. Huge thank you to Rod Adams. Oh my goodness, your support is really going a long way to keep Talk Nerdy on the air and 100% free to download for everyone who's interested. Again, guys, thank you so much for tuning in week after week. And this week, to celebrate my 100th episode, I think some of you may love it, some of you may hate it. I'm really excited to hear your feedback. It's been a busy time, and I'll probably get into it a little bit more because I know that some of you have asked questions about all of the work that I do. It's been a very busy time. I've been traveling like every other day, and I wanted to do something really big and really special for the 100th episode, like get a really huge guest on. But alas, it just wasn't in the cards with the amount of work that I've been kind of spreading myself thin to do. So I asked you guys what you recommended, and you said, why don't we flip the script? Why don't you interview me? And I can answer basically your AMA, your Ask Me Anything questions. I sourced them on Twitter and on Facebook. You guys sent in a whole bunch. So I'm just going to randomly skip around and answer some of these questions. It should be a fun one. We'll see how open this is. I'm kind of nervous, but I know that you guys sent in some great questions. So, all right, here we go. Let's start on Facebook. Here we've got a question. From Sawed Off Dabs and Smokes. All right, I want to ask you, Cara Santa Maria, will you ever have Professor Brian Cox and Sam Harris on the Talk Nerdy podcast? Guys, I would love to. I've never met Brian in real life. He's not in the U.S. that often. He is in the U.K. Sam Harris is local. He's actually in Los Angeles, and I have met him a couple of times along with his lovely wife, Annika, who is also, by the way, on my list to have on the podcast. She's a brilliant author. She wrote a really great children's book that is a secular book in nature about wonder and excitement called I Wonder. And I would actually love to have all of them on the podcast. So guys, this is an open invitation if you're listening. But for sure, they're on the list, and you know I'm always working hard to get my guests on. But I do the podcast all by my lonesome. I don't have a producer to help me with that kind of booking. So hopefully, in time, we'll see. I've got another question here from Lee Jones. Have you ever been to Europe? What's your favorite country? Did you visit CERN? Can we go there together? Lee, I don't know you, so not likely that we'll be traveling together anytime soon. I have been to Europe many times. I have not visited CERN. I've actually only been kind of in the area of the Alps on the German side. I've been to Munich, and I've also visited, Vienna. I visited Venice. I loved that trip. It was really, really fun. I've also been to Spain. I went to Spain with my mother, which was really fun because my mother, of course, is a native Spanish speaker. Although she's from Puerto Rico, the Spanish in Spain is very different. So it was interesting to see her trying to get around with the kind of communication barrier that she had. Mine was obviously much worse. I'm your standard kind of second generation Latina who really doesn't speak Spanish much at all. I know textbook Spanish. I probably speak at like a third grade level, present tense only, people. I can read it and write it much better than I can speak it or hear it. Hearing it is the hardest part. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that my father is not Spanish. He's actually Italian. And so my mother didn't really speak it in the home growing up. So I didn't really hear it much. But I digress. We went to Spain together and it was a whole lot of fun. We went to Madrid and Barcelona, or I should say Barcelona, as they say. Let's see. I've also been to London. I was only in London for a day for work. It was fun. I did a shoot for Vice and GE where we scanned the BT Tower. Actually, we scanned the city from the BT Tower with terrestrial LiDAR scanning. And I learned a lot. And yeah, it was great. It was short and exhausting. I basically got off the plane, slept, shot all day, slept, got back on the plane. It was pretty rough. But London is beautiful. I'd love to go back sometime. Let's see. Where else have I been? Oh, Paris. I've been to Paris multiple times. I think that so far Paris is my favorite city in Europe. Any French listeners out there, I love your city. I love Paris. It's just beautiful. It's magical. You can eat croissants every day. Nobody judges you for it. And there's this kind of lifestyle there that's much more laid back. Get a coffee, get a tea. I don't know, breathe in the day, which I feel like we don't always get here in the States. Los Angeles, I think I get it more so than when I lived in New York or even Texas, which is why I think this is such a good city for me, especially with the history of kind of depression and mental health issues that I faced before, which we'll probably get into. But yeah, I do love Paris. I've not yet been to a lot of cities, though. I'm realizing that. A lot of times I only get to travel for work because it's expensive. It's really expensive to travel. When I have to do it for work, it's a good trip. Here's hoping for Rome. I think that's where I want to go next. Oh, God, and I almost forgot. In Paris, you can go to the catacombs. If you are planning a trip to visit Paris anytime soon, I know the line is long. I know it seems daunting. It is so, so fucking worth it. Go to the catacombs. You won't regret it. It's beautiful. It's fascinating. It's macabre. It's interesting. It's this just weird underbelly of the city where there's 6 million Parisian bodies buried. I mean, they're all bones now because they were taken from other graves and put in there after they had become bones, but they're displayed in this really kind of beautiful and creepy way. I don't know. I absolutely love it. Paris, guys. Paris. All right, let's see. I just want to kind of pick these at random. Oh, yes, I will get to the final two at the end, I promise. That looks like it's the most common question. Ooh, what would you ask yourself that no one has ever asked? God, that's hard. I've got to think about that one for a little while. Let's see. How do we get more people to vote? You guys, if I knew the answer to that... How do we get more people to vote? I think we have to mobilize people in a way that makes them feel passionate. I think that it's not just up to the candidates. I think it's up to us to have more, I don't know, important conversations about civic duty and about why it's important that we actually make it to the polls. But again, I know in our country specifically, in the United States, it's difficult. We have a bipartisan system, and a lot of times people really think that, you know, neither candidate supports them. I'm not sure if this election cycle is different. It's going to be super bizarre. I mean, it looks like the front runner on the Republican side is Trump, WTF. On the Democratic side, it really could be anybody's game. Hillary and Bernie. Yeah, apparently we're on a first name basis. It's a tough one. You know, I think that right now my card is in the hat. Is that an expression? My card is in the hat. I don't know, but it is. My card is in the hat for Bernie Sanders. I hope that he gets the nomination. He has just been a massive advocate and supporter of the civil rights movement for many, many years. He is one of the few candidates that we see who hasn't really changed his mind much, except to grow and learn and become more progressive. And I think that that is something that means a lot to me in a politician and a representative. I'm not one of those people who would blame somebody for flip-flopping per se. I think changing your mind is important. It's a scientific virtue. And if you find out new data, you find out new information, or you kind of grow with the times, obviously changing your mind can be a really good thing. And I think we've seen that happen with Bernie Sanders in the past. But when it comes to core values like civil rights, like freedom for every person, like equal rights for every person, he's been on the right side of history just across the board. And that's really impressive to me. And he doesn't seem to sway with popular opinion. He doesn't seem to sway with what he thinks will get him elected. So for that reason, I think that I am, I'm feeling the burn, you guys. Let's see. Oh, here's an interesting one from John Colgrove. So far, only Twitter. I mean, fuck. Sorry. So far, only Facebook. I'll get to Twitter soon, I promise. Do you plan on debating skeptics / science communicators / professionals on your podcast in the future? What about other science figures you have clear disagreements with? So I guess let me approach this one of two ways. The first is, let's talk about a structured debate. Typically, these are like ticketed events where people show up and there's a clear opinion on one side, a clear opinion on the other side, and you have these arguments that you make in point, counterpoint. You remember debate team. And that is something that I don't do. It's something that I don't engage in. And that's mostly just because I'll probably not do well. Like, honestly, I don't debate creationists for that very reason. It's not because I think that they're right or that they'll stump me. I don't. I mean, creationists are full of shit, and I am adamantly on the pro-truth and pro-fact and pro-science side. But the reason I don't debate creationists is because I don't know if I would win the debate. It's not because evolution isn't true. Of course evolution's true. It's not because creationism even has an inkling of truth in it. It doesn't. It's absolutely false. It's because I'm not a debater. I'm not trained in sort of the art and science of debating. And so such an important thing there is wordsmithing. It's being able to hear an argument and twist it in such a way to reaffirm. There's no judge there making sure that you're not making logical fallacies. And I'm just not sure that I would ever be good at that. So why would I open myself up to potentially making the skeptical movement, the atheist movement, look bad because I'm just not good at debate? On the flip side of that, I think that if I were to have people on the podcast that I disagree with, and I'm sure I have before, that I like to push back a little bit on their ideas and try and understand them a little bit better. David Silverman is going to come on the podcast soon. He is the president of American Atheists, and he also wrote a book called Fighting God, which is a great book. I recommend you buy it, A, because it's wonderful, B, because I wrote the foreword to it. And it's called Fighting God, an Atheist Manifesto for a Religious World. It's interesting because I don't agree with a lot of what's in it. I mean, we're both atheists and we're both pretty adamant and outspoken, but he really advocates for firebrand atheism, this specific kind of flavor that I think there's room for and I think is absolutely necessary, but is not necessarily the flavor that I adopt. And I don't think everybody should, as David often posits. He thinks that there's no such thing as an atheist Jew. I fervently disagree with that assertion. So thank you for the tip, because I think that now I will bring that into our conversation a little bit more. I think it is important sometimes to push back. It's not something that's always on the top of my mind. I'm not the most antagonistic person. And I'm just often, when I have these guests on the podcast, I'm interested to hear their perspective. I'm interested to learn from them. But I think that if there's a perspective that I have that's well thought out, that is contradictory to their own. I think that those kinds of healthy discussions are important. All right. Oh, here's a good one from Timmy Utley, maybe. Do you have any friends slash family that are anti-GMO, and have you attempted to change their thoughts on the subject? If so, were you successful? That's a tough one. You know, I don't think I have any direct family that's anti-GMO that I can think of, and that's probably partly because I grew up in Texas, and this is one of those weird situations where the more conservative side on the political spectrum does tend to be pro-ag and pro-GM more so than the more progressive side on the political spectrum. And my family is mostly quite conservative. So, I mean, I disagree with them about a lot of stuff, but I'm not sure if I've ever had to have that GMO debate with anybody in my family. Now, friends, come on. I live in LA. Like, so many people here are anti-GMO. Have I been able to change any hearts and minds? I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure if I would ever say that Dave Rubin, for example, who does the Rubin Report, was ever anti-GMO, but he's definitely had me on the show multiple times to talk about genetically modified organisms, and it seems like he's been really perceptive to the things that I have to say and maybe opened his mind a little bit. I've definitely had fans, listeners, and people I know write in and tell me that their perspective has shifted a little bit, which is a good feeling. I would venture to guess that some of the people that I'm close to that are really anti-GMO won't say it out loud to me because they don't want to have that conversation. If you haven't noticed, I have a pretty strong personality. I say what's on my mind. I'm not that good at sugarcoating things. And I think most of my friends know where I stand on a lot of the main core issues, especially the ones that I've made it a part of my mission in my SciComm work to elucidate. So when it comes to GMOs, yeah, I think most people know where I stand and they don't really want to have that argument with me. I've had a couple people tell me that they're against it, and we've had a conversation and they've said, oh, okay, I get it. I haven't really thought of it that way. But who knows if that's changed their buying habits or their voting habits or even their perspective. But that's a great question. So thank you for sending that in. I've also got one here from Matt Milligan that says, what kind of dinosaur is tattooed on your arm? It's an Archaeopteryx, and it's specifically the Berlin specimen of Archaeopteryx lithographica. It's a really meaningful dinosaur to me, A, because it's beautiful, but B, because it's kind of a fuck you to creationists. You know, people talk about the missing link and where are all the missing links. This is such a beautiful example of a missing link. I hope you're Googling it right now if you don't already know what Archaeopteryx is. But it really is this interesting character that has both bird-like features and dinosaur-like features. I call it a dinosaur. Some paleontologists call it a dinosaur, but some ornithologists and paleontologists actually call it a bird because it really does just have both features. You know, it has a beak, but it has teeth. It has these beautiful feathers, and so much research has been done on Archaeopteryx because they're such beautiful preserved specimens. And genetic research has been done. Researchers actually know that they had, for example, black feathers. How amazing is that, that they could find out what color their pigment is? I just love it. There's just a wealth of knowledge surrounding Archaeopteryx, and I think the Berlin specimen specifically is a beautiful fossil. It's one of the best preserved fossils we've ever seen, and you really get a sense of the organism as a whole, and you can transport yourself back to that place. You know, you can kind of imagine what it was like when these beautiful beasts were roaming the earth and the skies. And I don't know. And I love the idea of these winged feathered dinosaurs. I love the idea that our minds have changed over the years. You know, I'm 32 years old. When I was young and I was learning about dinosaurs, they were all scaly. None of them had fluff. None of them had fuzz. And now we know that T-Rex was fluffy. I mean, what the hell? It's hard for people to take it first, but once you start to understand it, it's so exciting because it's almost like learning it all over again as a child. And I mean, really, who doesn't love dinosaurs? I know you guys never grew out of your dinosaur phase, just like me. One funny thing, I may have mentioned it on the show before. I have this ridiculous collection of, they're called Carnegie dinosaurs, the Carnegie collection. And they're these scale model replicas. I think that they're all like 1/40th of size. That's probably still too big. Maybe it's smaller than that. I'm looking it up right now. Carnegie dinosaur. I have to like say it out loud as I'm typing. Scale. But the nice thing is they're all scaled together. So the great thing is that you can sort of put them next to each other and you can see how big they were kind of side by side, which is really exciting. I don't know. I'm a huge nerd. You can go to the wiki page and it has them all spelled out. They started being made in 1989. I think the last ones were made in 2015. Oh, they're all different scales. Oh, that's bumming me out. No, most of them are 1/40th. I was right. There's just a few, like the really, really small dinosaurs that they did 1/10th, just so you can see their features. But yeah, being able to put them next to each other is really fun. And they're not all dinosaurs. There are a couple of mammals. You know, there's a woolly mammoth. There's also some swimming reptiles, mosasaur, a plesiosaur, I think. There's some flying reptiles like Quetzalcoatlus and like a pteranodon and things like that. But then there are also a lot of great dinosaurs, both babies and adults. And I don't know, you can play with them. It's embarrassing. but I love it. I love my collection. People kind of laugh at me when they see it, but I don't care. I still play with them because why not? I was going to say something else about dinosaurs, but I can't remember what it is. One of these days, I want to do a dinosaur show. Wouldn't it be cool to get a dinosaur television show, like a really solid show on TV? Not like the sitcom, you remember? Not the mama, not that one. And, you know, not like a standard Attenborough-esque, you know, CG with a narrator talking about the fantastic musculature. Like, I would much rather do a fun show where you meet with the paleontologist and you learn about active science that's happening in paleontology, because there's so much cool stuff that's being done with grinding up bones and looking for DNA and really understanding the physiological structure and the difference between young dinosaurs and old dinosaurs and how did they mate and how did they fight and what did they eat. And we can tell that based on their fossilized shit, these coprolites. There's so much cool stuff. Wouldn't that be fun to do a dinosaur show? I need to get on that. Snap my fingers and make it be. Oh, if only TV production worked that way. Yeah, I don't know. They've captured my imagination since I was a child. I think that I was one of those kids who had a hard time believing in things. I didn't really ever believe in Santa that I can remember. I never had that moment, you know. I can't point back to that moment when I realized Santa wasn't real. And I don't think I ever really believed in God. I think I was always kind of atheistic, but didn't know it and was trying to please my parents. And for me, dinosaurs were those magical, mythical beasts, except they weren't mythical. You know, it wasn't a dragon or a unicorn. It was a real thing that's just as fantastic as anything your imagination could come up with, any beautiful chimera. But they lived, they existed, and there's just a wealth of knowledge about them. But you also get to play detective and play, you know, mystery man. You get to play paleontologist yourself. You get to dig them out of your sandbox and try and piece together the different bones and learn all of their names, just the thousands of names and where they lived and how big they were and what they ate. And I don't know, it fascinated me. I even took a paleontology course in college. I always thought I was going to be a paleontologist, but alas, life took other turns. All right, you think that's enough about dinosaurs? Let's see. Let's maybe switch over to Twitter and then we can come back to Facebook. So on Twitter, I need to sort of spread this out a little bit because they're all over the place. Let's see. Oh, how do you deal so well with depression? That's from Rich Vernon. I think that that's an interesting question. I think it's a little bit misleading because it implies that I do deal really well with it. Oh my gosh, my dog is scratching on the staircase and it's really loud. I'm going to ask him to stop. I'm going to move my face away from the mic so that you can't hear me yelling in your ear holes.
Killer! Maybe no scratchies. Come here.
He's not going to come to me, but he's looking at me like I'm a crazy person. Hi. Well, that's good. Hey, guys. Killer says hi. Yeah. So Rich Vernon, how do you deal so well with depression? I think that that question implies, A, that I deal really well with it, which I'm not sure if that's true. I'm not sure if anybody actually feels that way when they do struggle with mental illness. But I manage, and I've been managing much better in recent years than I did in the past. So quick background on that. I've kind of carried a diagnosis of major depressive disorder since I was a child. As far back as I can remember, at least, I was always going to shrinks. My parents were divorced when I was maybe like six, and I know that they had me in some sort of weird group therapy, some family therapy. I sometimes went to Mormon therapists. God, that probably fucked me up more than like having a good therapist would. They also, oh yeah, because I was raised Mormon, if you didn't know. They also made sure that if I wasn't doing well in that way, that they were there for me, and that they made sure that I had access to counseling and to mental health professionals and counselors at school, which is great because I've always been a bit of a quiet, kind of introverted, darker kid. Like, I wasn't a loud, boisterous kid. I was really kind of weird and kept to myself. And there was a darkness to me. I wrote a lot of like super sad poetry. But it was more than that. It wasn't this superficial idea of what you think a person with depression is. There was true pain happening. And, just like many people with depression, I never knew why. And that was always so frustrating for me. Why am I sad all the time? Why do I have these episodes where no matter what I do, no matter how I think, no matter if I go on a fucking run, like everybody says, oh, go exercise, go on a run, or if I eat some salad, or, you know, think positive thoughts, like no matter what I fucking did, I couldn't get out of it. Sometimes it was so bad that I was, you know, contemplating doing things that probably wouldn't have ended well. And I even, when I was a teenager, I had a long stretch where I struggled with cutting, which I think is an interesting phenomenon for anybody who's listening who hasn't dealt with it, or maybe who has, because I think there are a lot of misconceptions about cutting that maybe, you know, you hear people say, oh, what a pussy, why don't you just off yourself already? Or, you know, you hear these horrible things about this activity as if it's like a suicidal attempt gone wrong, or I'm trying, but I'm not quite there yet. It has nothing to do with that, at least for many people, especially young women who deal with this. It's a control issue, and it's an issue of experiencing a pain that has a source, if that makes sense. So when you're experiencing the anguish of a major depressive episode, this inconsolable dark sadness that swallows you whole, where it's almost like quicksand. No matter what you do, you can't get your head above that level. You can't breathe, and it's inconsolable. I don't know. There's not many other words to describe it. When you do something like that, when you harm yourself in that way, I think that the reason it's so appealing to so many people who are in that situation is because there's a source, and you can see it, and you can feel it, and you bleed, and then you clean the wound, and you know why it hurts. And that sharp kind of physical pain sort of, at least for a little while, overwhelms the emotional pain. And so it's a coping mechanism. It's not a healthy coping mechanism, and it's not a coping mechanism that really works in the long term, but it has a source of immediate relief. And I think that that's why I did it. Now, like I said, I've been to therapy my whole life, but I always resisted medication. And I think that I did so because I was afraid that somehow, if I took drugs, it would mean I was that kind of depressed. It would mean that I was crazy. It would mean that I was sicker than I was. You know, I could say I'm sick. I could say I deal with depression. I could advocate for erasing the stigma, but I don't need meds. I really had that line drawn in the sand, and it was hard to describe why, but it was there, and it was a major sticking point. And not like four or five years ago, when I was here in Los Angeles, before my career started taking off as much as it did in science communication, when I was trying to decide if leaving my PhD program and venturing into this new world of media was the right decision, And also, like, after some pretty intense breakups and some other personal events in my life, I was not in a good way. I was more depressed than I could remember. It kind of harkened back to that darkness that I had felt when I was maybe in late middle school or early high school. And I finally decided, fuck it. Like, I need to do something about this, you know? And I had a shrink. I had been going to therapy, but I was like, I think I need more than that. And so I talked to a psychiatrist and they recommended one drug that I took that made me go out of my fucking mind. It was like an SNDRI, a serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine reuptake inhibitor. It was insane. I didn't sleep for days. I felt like I was on meth. Not that I've ever done meth, but I'm assuming that's what meth feels like. I did quit smoking when I was on it because it was partially like an analog to Chantix, which is crazy. So that was one good side effect. But I eventually called the psychiatrist and was like, well, what are you doing to me? I can't say. And they were like, oh my God, stop taking it. What's wrong with you? So I stopped taking that, reworked things. I ended up on citalopram, which is a straight SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And wouldn't you know, it worked. I mean, the first few days were tough because I was crazy tired on it. I sort of recalibrated. I started taking it at night instead of in the morning. And eventually I got into a groove. And now I've been taking it for years, 20 milligrams of citalopram, that's Celexa, every night. And it's changed my life. Like, I don't think I can express how different my life is now that I have the right balance of medication and therapy. And I say this with a huge disclaimer that I'm not you and you're not me and everybody's experience is different. Some people really benefit from medication. Some do not. Some people find the right meds quicker. Some people do not. All of this kind of work that you do, you need to be doing with a mental health professional, with a trained psychotherapist and or psychiatrist. But that said, I will say very firmly that there's no reason to be ashamed if medication and therapy are the right thing for you. And there's absolutely nothing willful. It's not a disease of will. You cannot will yourself out of experiencing depression because it is a core biological illness that has many features having to do with your psychology, of course, your history, how you have experienced trauma and loss in your life, how you were raised, what your relationship was like with your family, what kind of flashbulb events you've experienced. But there's also a core biological component that we cannot deny anymore. The science is in on that. And if you personally are experiencing depression, it's not because you're not smiling enough. It's not because you aren't strong enough. And I think that that's a huge misunderstanding, especially that we have in American culture that we have to push through. I think the other thing that I would say to anybody who asks is that you're also not alone, because good God, does it feel like it. I know when you're in that place, it just feels like nobody else has ever felt this kind of grief and nobody else would ever understand what you're going through. And the truth is that a lot of the people that are closest to you might not. And so that can be a barrier, that can be difficult. But trust me, you're not alone. Trust me, there are many, many people out there who fully understand that experience, who have been there. There are people who will be there, and there are people who understand, and you can learn from them, and you can speak to them, and you can have a relationship with them or not, or just seek comfort in knowing that you're not alone, because I think that that's really important and it always kind of carried me through. Okay, let's see. What else do we got? What else do we got? Do, 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 do. My Twitter feed is really confusing because apparently I tweet a lot. So I think I need to go about this another way. I'm going to find the tweets. I think I've tweeted about this twice for you guys to send in your questions. I never realized how many tweets I get. That's why I don't always answer you guys. I try my best to answer you both on Twitter and Facebook, but I know it gets backlogged quite a bit because I just have a lot that I'm dealing with. So I'll be at work and then I'm trying to get to everybody. And eventually I do some of you I miss, and I really apologize for that. But that's why, because it's just I'm probably a little bit inundated. Okay, let's see. Where is it? Where is it? I've also been getting help lately. I'm not sure if you noticed, but I'm working with a friend who is helping me with my social media because it's been really overwhelming, and she's doing a really great job. Don't worry, I'm still there every day. I'm still accessing it all, but it's nice to get a little bit of that heavy lifting, a little bit of help with that. All right, so here is one. Let's see. Are there any episodes you wish you could do over? Oh, for sure. I wish I could do the Lawrence Krauss episode over because A, he was like super drunk when I was interviewing him. It was late at night at a conference. Super drunk and like sort of inappropriate. So that was not fun for me. It was a really uncomfortable experience. And also, I don't think it was a very good interview because of that. And it was short. Like I couldn't get enough time. Most of my interviews, I try to keep somewhere around an hour. And I get it. Some people have time crunches. So 45 minutes, I think, is appropriate. But that one was really short. And I don't know. I didn't get out of it what I would hope for. That was the biggest one that sticks out in my mind. Let's see. No. I can't really answer some of those because they're questions that aren't in my field, like time dilation. I'm like, ask Bob Novella. He could probably answer that a little bit better. I know that I have one more time that I tweeted about this. You didn't see when I told you that I was going to be doing an Ask Me Anything, you didn't know that half of it would be me just digging around online trying to find questions. Okay, here we go. Omar CCX says, you said you miss smoking weed. Will we ever listen to a high talk nerdy podcast? probably not. And when I say I miss smoking weed, I think I miss a lot of things about that period of my life. I miss the nostalgia. I did enjoy it quite a bit, but there was a period in my life where I smoked weed like all the time. And I think I balanced my life quite well. I did experience that sort of immotivational syndrome, that lack of motivation that you sometimes get when you're high a lot. But I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. But then just kind of out of the blue, I started getting really anxious when I would smoke. I would get these panic attacks where I felt like I couldn't breathe and I could like feel my pulse. Like I could feel the blood coursing through my body. I was quite aware of my circulatory system the whole time I was high. And I was like, this is horrible. And the weird thing is, those panic attacks persisted for many years, even after I quit smoking weed. And then eventually they died off. And I had a whole system of how to deal with a panic attack if it happened when I was driving, if it happened when I was in class. This was in college and it was a huge bummer. But I tried to smoke a couple of times since then, like, you know, many years later, I would try once and then it just instantly came back, just super anxious and not paranoid, not like, ooh, everybody knows I'm high. It was more of a, ugh, I don't like the way this feels. I don't like the way my body feels. It's really bummed me out. But I think that that's just sort of how things are now. And, you know, I don't drink, so I'm sober all the time. Super weird. Super weird. People ask me why I don't drink. It's not because I ever had a problem. It's not because I'm in a program. I was just, you know, when I was young, I smoked a lot of pot and I had my fun with what you have fun with when you're young, with psychedelics, with LSD, with mushroom. I didn't really like mushrooms, but with ecstasy, that was fun for me. With some pills, like that was a thing that I did for a while, not advocating, just being honest and reporting on my history. I just never developed a taste for alcohol. People say it's like it's an acquired taste. I'm like, ugh, why would I acquire that? It tastes really bad to me. I don't like being out of control. And like my mantra has always been, now since I don't do anything, I don't mind being around people while they're drinking, but I hate being around people when they're drunk. And on the flip side, I don't like being around people while they're getting high, because like you get a contact high, but I don't mind people that are already high. It's just two very different substances. Drunk people annoy me. Drinking is not fun for me. So yeah, I'm sober all the time, but likely, Omar, you will not hear a high talk nerdy because the whole time I would just be going, I just want to come down. Wouldn't be very fun. Let's see. You aren't a soul, and your brain manufactures all kinds of superstitions. Who are you? Do you exist then? Are you fake? That's from John Pratt. Wow, that's a very existential question, John Pratt. I'm me, and I am real, and I know that I'm real because you agree that I'm real. You've seen me, and there's a consensus there. I definitely went through my solipsist phase when I was in college, and I was reading a lot of existential philosophy, and it's like, oh, if we're all just an invention in our own heads, maybe we all have our own personal realities. It doesn't really hold water scientifically. It's an interesting thought experiment, but there's so much consensus, and there's just so many things that multiple people and multiple entities have reinforced that this idea of solipsism, to me, is a thought experiment at best. So when you ask if I exist, I do exist. Who am I? That's a loaded question. I'm Kara. That's my scapegoat answer. No, I am who I am. And who I am is very different to me than it probably is to you. I wouldn't say that I'm fake, though. What you hear, I should say, is what you get. What you see is not always what you get when I do television because, you know, I don't know. TV is a little bit different. You have to wear makeup. You have to dress a certain way. And it depends on the show that I do when I'm more me and when I'm a little bit less me. I'm always me, but sometimes I'm, I don't know, host, like more hosty than I am in life. But the podcast is very me. Speaking of, maybe I'll tell you why I have been so busy lately. So I've been working on this new show called America's Greatest Makers. It's really exciting. It's a reality competition show. It's going to air on TBS in April. And it's all about the maker community. So it's a competition where these teams are competing to win $1 million. It's funded and supported by Intel. So they're using some interesting Intel technology. It's got a great panel of judges. And I've been shooting on that show a lot lately. And the interesting thing is there's a companion series that goes along with it, America's Greatest Makers Digital Channel. You can see it right now on the web if you go to americasgreatestmakers.com. But that requires that I travel almost every week to shoot these wonderful wraps in all of these great maker spaces around the country. My job is awesome. It's so awesome. But lately, I've also been shooting the show, which is on set here in LA. But that's not it. I work on 4 television shows. So there's that. There's a kid show on Friday mornings. I'm sorry, talking too fast. Scratch that. There's a kid show on Saturday mornings on Fox called Fab Lab, and it's really targeted towards girls kind of age 11, maybe 9 to 14, somewhere in that range, like the tween girls. And we focus on things that really matter to girls. We focus on science topics, but we talk about how we can affect the world for the better, how we can help people, how we can change the world, and pets too, because young girls are definitely excited about helping out when it comes to domestic animals. So we focus on the kinds of things that we know matter. So there's those two. I also obviously have worked on a show on Al Jazeera America for over 2 years now called Techno. Al Jazeera America is actually going by the wayside. The whole network is ceasing operations. So that show is, as far as we know, done, if not on hold. I mean, who knows if another network will pick us up? Who knows if there's options, you know, if it'll have legs anywhere else. But as far as we know, we did wrap our last episode, which will air in a few weeks. And we did have a wrap party, which is very, very sad. But I have been working for years on that show. And then lastly, here in Los Angeles, we have a great television network called KCET, which is a local public television network, which means we don't have commercials. It's all, you know, user submission, user, listener, viewer. That's the word I'm looking for. Viewer submissions, viewer support. We depend on the support of viewers like you. And the show that I work on there is called SoCal Connected. It's a great show, a news and public affairs magazine style show. You've probably seen some of the clips online. Because the great thing about this show is even though it airs locally, we get every episode in digital form too, so I can share them. I recently did a story about urban beekeeping. I did another story about the mountain lions here in the Santa Monica Mountains in Los Angeles. And then I have a couple episodes coming out soon, one about death over dinner and the death positive movement, and another one about sex trafficking, about human trafficking of young women and men in Los Angeles. It's a huge bummer, I know. So that one's kind of all over the place, but I put my heart and soul into that show. We've been lucky enough to win last year, gosh, with the team, we won a Golden Mike Award, a Los Angeles Press Club Award, and actually for a feature that I did on the Natural History Museum, I won a local Emmy on the story about the bug bet, which is a citizen science program to identify different fly species here in Los Angeles. So gosh, I mean, so much fun on that show. So those four shows dominate my time because I'm also doing Talk Nerdy and The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Wow. And there's always new stuff coming along. You know, when I wrap on one thing, the hope is that I get something else. I have an incredible agent who helps me stay working, because a weird thing about this world of media and LA TV and all that good stuff and the web is that the more you work, the more you get work. So I'm always really happy to be working. I know sometimes I complain. Sometimes we all complain when we're tired or when we're overworked. But I always try to bite my tongue when that happens because I feel like I've been really, really fortunate. So that's kind of what's going on in my world. Let me see. Ooh, what's your favorite science fiction book? That's from Jeff Koppen, or maybe it's Koppen. My favorite science fiction book. Oh. Flowers for Algernon, probably. I love Flowers for Algernon. Yeah, that might be my favorite science fiction book. I've read a lot of nonfiction over the years, and I don't really read much sci-fi in the classical sense. I mean, I do like some classic Vonnegut. The Illustrated Man is a great book. I love 1984. I love, you know, Orwell, and that kind of mid-century sort of socially aware and socially conscious sci-fi is a little bit more my steez. I'm not that into the sort of, I don't know, I guess Lord of the Rings isn't actually sci-fi, that's fantasy, but I'm not into the fantasy sci-fi genre, you know, the stories that where there's whole worlds that are created and you have to follow who all the characters are and really understand all of their subplots. It's not really my jam. I like stories more that have something that I can take out of them and apply to culture. I'm also not that into like just basic stories about good and evil. So I like a good science fiction film from time to time, but as you know from following me on Skeptic's Guide, if you have, I'm the one who's always like, what movie are you talking about? What book is that? What is Dune? Like, they are huge sci-fi fanatics, and a lot of the listeners are too, and it's fun for me to learn as I go. Like, they made me watch every Star Wars ever, which was hard, but I think important for my, you know, professional development. But I would have to say, I don't know, maybe Flowers for Algernon. I don't even know if that counts as sci-fi, but it's such a great book. And it is fiction. And I mean, it's got science in it. All right, let's see. Juan Nunez says, considering that the state of science education is terrible in some places, would you ever go into teaching? I used to teach. I miss teaching. It's probably the thing I miss the most. I taught at the college level. I was first a TA and then an adjunct professor between Texas and New York. So at the University of North Texas, which is where I did my undergrad and my master's, and then also at Queens College of the CUNY system, the City University of New York, because I started a PhD up there. And so that's how you support yourself when you're a graduate student, is you teach a lot. But that's really where the shift into science communication and science education came to be, because I found myself liking teaching more than I liked doing the wet work, the bench work. Like, I was never in the research lab and I was always in the classroom. I taught intro biology, so bio 101. I taught anatomy and physiology. I taught animal physiology, which is kind of an upper level, like senior level course. And then I taught psych 101. And I loved it. I loved every day of it. I loved my students. I loved learning. You really don't know anything until you teach it. I can attest to that. I still don't think I have a good grasp on anatomy and physiology because there's so much memorization, which was never my strong suit. But I miss it. I miss it every day. And probably there will be a time when I find that balance and I'm able to teach part-time and continue to do the media work that I've been doing, because it absolutely matters to me. And it's so much fun. That being said, I do feel like I'm fortunate enough that the type of work that I do now is sort of like teaching. I know it's not the same. It's entertainment first. I don't know if I can say this episode has been. I hope so. But gosh, you guys, it's weird to just talk for an hour, like to nobody. I'm envisioning your faces on the other side of like my laptop screen while I'm looking through it, or on the other side of this microphone. But I am just sort of sitting here in my dining room. I talk about my dining room all the time too. Oh, we'll get to that. I'm sitting here in my dining room, Killer sleeping at my feet. I'm just like hanging out, talking to nobody and everybody at the same time. It's sort of weird. You should try it sometime. Start a podcast. It's crazy. I did mention I'm in my dining room. We still haven't moved. The house is going to be ready in a week, you guys. I'll be able to move to my new place and set up my office. It'll probably be a few weeks before the office is set up and soundproofed and I can like upgrade to new mics. But oh my God, it's finally happening. I can't wait to bring in new guests there where it's like legit. I'll send pictures through the interwebs. You'll love it. Okay. What else we got? Let's go back to Facebook because I feel like there were just so many questions there. And I know that I asked twice and I only got to go through the first time that I asked. So here. Oh, and if you guys are ever interested in what is going on with me, definitely I recommend Facebook and Twitter. That's where I post most of my stuff. I mean, you can go to carasantamaria.com, but it's not interactive. That's just where you can see video clips. But if you want to like say hi, if you want to see what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis, interact, chat, this is the best place to do it is Twitter and Facebook. I'm a little more active on Twitter. This I know. I just feel like Facebook is a bit of a different platform, but we can roll with both of them. I'm on Insta too, but I'm not that visual a person. I just don't live my life taking photographs a lot. I'm not like, oh, I need to take a picture of my eggs. I mean, I'll do it, but I don't get it. I don't understand why that's interesting to people. I also find it really weird on Instagram. If you look at the number of likes on your pictures, all the ones that do well are selfies. So it's like my face has to be in it for it to do well, which is annoying to me because I don't wear makeup unless I'm on TV and I'm just lazy and kind of look a mess all the time. So you'll see on Insta when there's a picture, if I look like halfway pretty, it's because somebody worked really hard on that. And I'm like, oh, I should utilize this. So that's why they're a little fewer and farther between. I want to get better at it. I also signed up for Snapchat. If you're interested, you can hit me up on Snapchat. I suck at it. I don't get it. If you're into it, teach me the ways of Snapchat because I'm trying to understand why it works for some people. I don't know. Hit me up and let me know because I'm very confused by Snapchat. But here we go. More questions. Justin Clark says, which interviews did you find the most rewarding or fun? By the way, love the show and look forward to hearing your answers. Oh, thanks, Justin. And there are a bunch of likes on that one, so I think people want to hear that. I think that probably one of my favorites, but I feel bad because it's like picking your favorite child, which I can't really speak to because I don't have kids. But people use that expression, so I assume it means something. I would say Dawn Johansson was probably one of my favorites. It was a really fascinating discussion about Lucy. He discovered Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis. And it was a fascinating discovery conversation about the discovery, but I didn't go in deep about that because you can find that info everywhere. Those are what his interviews are always about. He did a talk about his time in Ethiopia at the museum. That's how I got to connect with him. But we sort of went off topic like we always do on the show. And we just started shooting the shit. And I found out that he's a hardcore atheist, that he has had some professional difficulties because of his atheism. And it was cool to get his perspective. You know, he's a much older man who has been incredibly successful in his field. I've looked up to him for years. And it was just such an honor to sit down with him and then to kind of hear that he's gone through some of the same things that I've experienced. I don't know. It meant a lot to me. So I enjoyed that that episode immensely. Bob Flisser says, I don't look anywhere near 100. Thank you, Bob. Let's see. If you had to choose another science concentration to study in school other than neurobiology, what would it be? That's a great question from Marcella Arocha Lidic. Probably paleontology, as I said. I did realize, though, that with paleo comes geology, and with geology comes a lot of rocks, which I was never that good at. So I'm not sure if I would actually have enjoyed it as much, but I do love paleo. On the flip side of that, how fucking awesome would it be to go into something like physics, like a field that I just am don't know nearly enough about because it just was not my focus in school. I was psych, I was bio, I was neuro, I was all of those wet sciences and like theoretical physics or even experimental physics, for example. I took some classes, but I did not dive deep. I only really learned what I know about physics now by working as a science journalist. So that would be fascinating to me. Hard, and I'd probably be a terrible student. I'd be lucky if I passed my classes, but it would be really fun. Let's see. Where do you see yourself in 10 and 25 years? That's Madeline Everett Monday. That's a hard question. I want you guys to answer that question for me because people ask it all the time, but it's not easy. So in 10 years, I will be 42 years old. The crazy thing is that I think about Killer more than I think about me because in 10 years, he'll be 16, which means he'll either be dead or he'll be wishing he were dead, which is a huge bummer to me. And I actually refuse to acknowledge that. I know I just said it out loud, but it's not real because Killer will never die. All I can think about is how hard it would be when I lose him. Oh my God, why did I even start having this conversation? 10 years. I will be killerless, which will make me horribly sad. I will be settled into the house that we purchased and loving it, I think. And I hopefully we'll have a rich career. You know, it's LA, which sucks because that means that there's a certain point in time when you don't get as much work anymore. I'm hoping at 42, I don't look like I'm 70. I'm hoping at 42, I'm still getting booked on things. I'm expecting to, but I had this idea when I first started in on-air science communication that for every sort of MTV-style show I would do, I'd make sure to do a PBS-style show too. And so far, I think I've had that balance. And the reason for that is I don't want to age into a place where I'm no longer getting booked because I'm not young and, quote, fun anymore. I want to make sure that the work that I do has a lot of gravity so that regardless of my age, there's an outlet for me to be able to do good journalism and do good science communication. You know, we have seen it work. We've seen it work with people like Jane Goodall, who really paved the road ahead. She is a scientist first and foremost. I am a communicator first and foremost. So I'm not sure if that path has been paved much from the perspective of a female science communicator. Let's hope that there are long legs. I will fucking fight for it. But yeah, that's where I hope to be in 10 years, kind of in the same place, just doing what I love. Hopefully doing episode, can't do math, 500, I think. But in 10 years it would be 600 of Talk Nerdy. Holy shit, that'd be crazy. 25 years, so that's 57 years old. I just hope to be healthy. I think that's the most important thing. I hope to be eating well and exercising, two things I am not very good at balancing now, and I hope to be healthy and know that I've got even more time after that. You know, you can't cheat the clock and you can't cheat disease and your own biology. You've just got to kind of hope for the best and handle what comes. And I just hope that even if difficulty comes my way, that I have the resilience to be able to deal with it. You know, it's funny when I am in a bad place, when I'm dealing with depression or when I'm dealing with the woes of the world that do come our way from time to time, death, illness. I often do think about the Serenity Prayer. And it's funny because I am, you know, not Christian, far from it. But I think that there's so much that you can take out of this prayer. And now granted, you don't have to start it with God grant me because no, fuck that. Grant yourself. Like I just hope to have the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's really that is life, isn't it? That is the path to peace and happiness, is understanding not to waste time and effort on things that are futile, but putting your effort into the things that matter, into the things that will have the greatest outcome, and obviously knowing the difference between the two, which really is the challenge. That's one of the hardest things we have to do in life, is we bang our head against the wall until we realize it's not doing anything. It's not making anything better. And then we move over to another wall and it moves for us. Oh, fuck. Why was I wasting so much time on that other wall? This is growth, I think. This is wisdom. This is prudence. And I hope to be more in that place as I age. Gosh, there's so much, you guys. How do you like your electric vehicle? Spark, right? Going to get a Bolt for the added range? I'm a Volt driver. I care about these things. That's from Joey Gill. Yes, yes, and yes. I love my Spark. Obviously, the frustration of it is that the range is too low. For the most part, it doesn't affect me because LA is, although you sit in traffic for like 2 hours, you're driving 5 miles. It's ridiculous. But there have been a few shoots, Santa Barbara, for example, where I can't go. So unless I can arrange a car or hitch a ride from somebody, I can't do the shoot. The Bolt, I'm very excited about. That's going to be the game changer, I think, having this much bigger range, but having it be an affordable car. I'm hoping to be an early adopter of that car. I'm hoping to see other people drive it too. I love when I see people on the street that drive the same car. I love waving to them. I used to have that with my little Toyota Yaris, and now I have it with my Spark. So yeah, let's see. Ooh, your favorite movie and television show of all time. Shit, this is hard. I have two favorite movies, but that's leaving out a lot. My favorite movie that is a comedy, I think, is I Heart Huckabees. It's fucking hilarious. It is like this farce that doesn't take itself too seriously. A lot of people say they don't get it. I think they're looking too deeply into it. It's just so funny to me. I die every time I see it. And probably my favorite serious movie is called A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints by Dito Montiel. A lot of people haven't seen it, but it's stunning. It's got weirdly Shia LaBeouf from a bygone time when I had a huge crush on him, but he's incredible in this movie. Channing Tatum, Rosario Dawson, just a really all-star cast. And it's this little indie movie that not a lot of people have seen, but it's just so good. It's beautifully acted, it's beautifully directed, and it's a coming-of-age story, and those usually appeal to me the most when it comes to films. So I'd say those are my favorite films. My favorite television show of all time is probably The Wire. I think it's probably the best show that's ever been on air. I also loved West Wing. I loved Breaking Bad. But The Wire, nothing has come close to The Wire, I don't think. So I would put that as my standard. Top 10 favorite albums. I can't do that. I have too many. I love Tool. I love Bad Religion. I love NOFX. I love classical music. That's all I listen to in my car is Ravel and Mozart and Beethoven and even Handel and Chopin and a lot of more modern classical music like Jan Tiersen, like film scores like John Williams or Jan Tiersen. I also love Olafur Arnalds. I guess I have a problem with road rage, so classical music in the car just calms me a little bit. I love jazz too. Let's see. Gosh, there's so much, you guys. I might have to do a part two. Here's what I'm going to do. I am going to stop there. I'm going to ask you guys if you're interested in a part two. Don't worry, I'll still answer the last two questions before we go. But please, please reach out to me. You can tweet me at Cara Santa Maria. You can visit my Facebook page, facebook.com/sciencecara. And yeah, like, let me know if you want me to do another one of these, or if you're like, oh my God, that's enough, Cara, because I totally get it if that's the case too. But yeah, there's more stuff to talk about. There's always more to talk about, but at some point you have to go to bed. So I want to thank you guys for listening. And oh yeah, I got to close with the last two questions. And I will tell you what, I have not thought about how I'm going to answer these. So I'm just as on the spot as everybody else. When I think about whatever context matters to me, what keeps me up the most at night? I think that probably tribalism is the thing that is the most frustrating to me in the world. And I think that it underpins most of our problems. And also, well, I don't know. I think tribalism underpins greed. It underpins the way that we have stratification of wealth in the world. And I think that obviously attributes to civil unrest, it attributes to civil justice. When we talk about elections being fair, so much of that comes to money. It comes to campaign finance reform, which we desperately need in this country. When we talk about climate change, so much of that comes to not my problem, it's your problem. How are we going to pay for it if you're not paying for it? It becomes this political bickering. That guy said that I don't have to believe in it. My in-group that says that God won't let me burn up in you know, a burning climate, says I don't have to worry about it. It's this in-group, out-group status. It's so central to who we are as humans. And I think that as we sort of quote-unquote evolve, both biologically but also socially, if we can even just work to understand our biases, we all have them, but just try and understand that the biases exist, that we have these first blush assumptions about people when we meet them. Oh, he's not like me. Oh, she's not like me. She's a different color. She has an accent. They come from a different place. They dress funny. They listen to music I don't like. I'm judging them. I'm thinking that they're not the same. I'm thinking they're other, which means worse, which means I'm afraid. All of those things that happen sort of below the conscious level of awareness that happen to all of us, if we can be aware of that and try and at least push through it and try and stop ourselves in our tracks and say, I'm going to give this person a fair shake. I think that so many of the problems in the world, the problems of poverty, the problems of hunger, the problems of war and aggression and religiosity and violence, I don't know, they would maybe be lessened. So I would say that tribalism is for sure the thing that bothers me the most and the thing I'm most concerned about, because in some respects it's getting better, but in many respects I see it getting worse. What am I most hopeful for? I think ingenuity, you know? I think that we amaze me. Humans amaze me. I wish that more people would stop and understand, though, that like that piece of technology that's in your hand or that Apple that you just took off the shelf, people worked hard to put it there. Like, it didn't just happen. Like, nature doesn't make iPhones. And nature doesn't even make apples the way that we eat our apples. These are things that were curated by brilliant people doing amazing science and engineering. And we've got to think about that in all the aspects and all the corners of our lives. The reason that our lives are as easy as they are, and I'm not saying they're easy by any stretch, especially if you live in an area where you don't have access to clean water, where you don't have access to reliable shelter or reliable food. But it's still so much better than it was in a pre-scientific era. It's still so much better than it was not 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It's always getting better. And we're seeing this happening in every corner of the earth as we become more connected with Wi-Fi, as we become more connected with cellular towers, with technology getting less expensive, with the empowerment of people to utilize the tools that we human beings dreamed up. It blows my fucking mind that we have that skill and that prowess. Kind of makes me feel lazy because I'm not sure I'm contributing. But I'm just so grateful. And I know that a lot of the major problems that we're facing, we can solve. It's about having the will to do so. That's really where the shortcomings fall. So I am hopeful and optimistic that we will think ourselves out of anything and we will think ourselves into a better place, because I know we can. I just hope we do it in a timely fashion, and I hope we can all agree as we sort of embrace the future together. All right, guys, it's been fun. I'm tired and I appreciate you guys listening and making it through. Thank you so much for 100 amazing episodes. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being my friend through this. It's been a labor of love, I'll tell you that. And I appreciate you so, so very much. Thanks for being here. And I look forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.